Masechet Baba Kama, Daf Pe Gimel, in which we hope to complete the seventh Perek and begin the eighth Perek. We mentioned the story yesterday of the siege between two Hasmonean brothers, which ended in terrible destruction. And from that time on, the rabbi said one is not allowed to teach Chochmat Yevanit to his son, Greek wisdom is not allowed. So now we challenge that. Chochmat Yevanit mi asira, is it true that Greek wisdom is prohibited to teach one's son? V'hatanya amar bi be'eretz Yisrael lashon sursi lama, o lashon hakodesh o lashon yevanit. V'amar bi yose, bavel lashon arami lama, o lashon hekdesh o lashon parsi. We have a challenge from a Braita in which Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says that in the land of Israel, why would anybody speak Syriac? Syriac is a language close to Aramaic, which was a very popular language among non-Jews. Also, Christians wrote a lot in Syriac. So why would someone learn, read and speak Syriac? Rather, he should use either Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, or Greek. What you see from this is that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi thought it was totally fine to speak Greek, and therefore it sounds like it would be fine to teach Greek to one son. So it seems like it's not allowed. And then Rabbi Yose said in parallel that in Bavel, why would someone speak Aramaic? Either one should speak Lashon HaKodesh, Hebrew, or the official language of the land, Persian. And both of these lands, most people in the land of Israel would speak some Greek, right? A little bit, but it was high language. Only someone who was very well educated or had connections to the government would speak Greek. The most common language among Jews and non-Jews was Aramaic. And then Hebrew also would be used certainly for prayer and study and also for conversation somewhat among Jews. In Persia, very few people would be speaking Greek. Very important people and very well-educated people or connected with the government would speak Persian. But the most common language Jews among Jews and non-Jews was Aramaic. So in both of these places, these rabbis are saying, why speak Syriac and Aramaic? Rather speak Hebrew, or the nice most, if you're not going to speak Hebrew, then at least pick a official, beautiful, high level language, not a low level language like Aramaic. Even though, most of the Talmud is in Aramaic, that's true. In Bavel, Persian, but in Israel, Rabbi Yehuda says, speak Greek. So it sounds like there's nothing wrong with Greek. So this is a challenge to what we said above. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi lives way after the Hasmonean brothers, so it should be under that ban, if indeed there is a ban against teaching Greek. Amri lashon yevani lechud v'chochmat yevanit lechud. And the answer is, Greek language is one thing. Greek wisdom is something else entirely. Greek language is okay. It's a beautiful language, and the Torah was translated into Greek, and so on, so that has good uses. But Greek wisdom, if it's, whatever that wisdom is, Homer, a mythology that contains a lot of idolatry, or it might be other negative ideas, or of general acculturation, assimilation. So that is what they had in mind when they said that's prohibited. Pechumat Yevanit, mi asira? And now we challenge that too. Is that true that Greek wisdom is prohibited? V'hamar av Yehuda mashimah mishum Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Ani olelad nafshi mikol benot airi. Elef yiladim hayu bebet haba. Chamesh me'ot mehem lamdu Torah. V'chamesh me'ot lamdu chochmat yevanit v'lo nishte mehem ela ani kan uben achi abba be'asya. Look, we have the statement in the name of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who was from the part of the dynasty of the Nasi, the patriarch who was the liaison between the Roman government and the Jewish community, very, very important position. And he said, quoting a pasuk from Echa, my eye affected my soul because all of the daughters of my city, meaning he's crying and lamenting because of all of the young people that were killed during the war. So what is he referring? He says, what does that refer to specifically? That there were 1,000 students in my father's house, in the house of the Nasi. 500 of them learned Torah. 500 of them learned Greek wisdom. It's not clear. I don't know if they switched in the middle so that they could learn both Torah and Greek wisdom, like a yeshiva university thing, half in the morning, half at night, or maybe some only learn Torah, others only learn Chabad Yevanit, whatever exactly the curriculum and the schedule was, doesn't matter. The point is that this was permitted to the house of the Nasi. They studied Chochmat Yevanit. They all, 1,000 people, students, were killed, except, he says, for myself and my cousin, who now lives in Asia Minor, the Roman controlled area of Asia. So you see that it is sounds like it's allowed to study Chochmat Yevanit. The answer is Amre Shani Bet Rama Gamliel Shukarabim Lamalchut. No, the house of Rama Gamliel is different because they had close ties with the government, and it's important not just to be able to speak Greek, but you have to do so properly. Part of the Greek education wasn't just simply the learning the vocabulary and the language; it was the art of rhetoric, of how to build an argument, have a beginning, middle, and end, persuasive speech that comes along with intonation and hand gestures and all kinds of references. And you have to be acculturated so that you can make references to things that a government officials know about. And maybe that will mean that you have to get their jokes and make references to homework. And all that is essential for Jewish survival. So this does not apply to a common Jew, just a regular person living in Jerusalem or in the Galilee or whatever. It's okay, they don't have to know all that. So they could study Greek language. This is not a very nice language, but they don't have to know all the Greek wisdom. However, for the house of the Nasi, we really need someone who will plead on behalf of the Jewish people and protect us and so on. So it was not permitted, but even essential for the house of Raman Gamliel to learn Greek wisdom. Uchedetanya hamisaper komi hareze midarkei mori abtolmos bari uben hitiru lo saper komi bneshu. And there are other examples of things that the rabbis made exceptions and permitted for diplomatic reasons. One who gets a komi haircut. This was a Greek style haircut that might have looked like just a round haircut where there's no hair on the sideburns and edges, or just completely round, kind of like a monk that looks like, or maybe something like a long hair in the back. So it's a Greek style haircut, and that's prohibited. Misaper, like sapad, right, to get a haircut like that, is called ways of the Amorites, as foreign ways, and one is not allowed to do that. However, there was this individual named Abtolmos, the son of Reuven, and the rabbis permitted him to get such a haircut because he was close to the government, and when he walks around in the Senate chambers or in official places, he has to fit in order to do his job. Shelabet Rabban Gamliel hitidu lahen lesaper, and similarly, for the house of Rabban Gamliel, they permitted them to speak about Chochmat Yevanit. Interesting, it's the same, it looks like the same verb, mesaper and lesaper, but here it doesn't mean haircut. Here it means to talk about, discuss matters of Greek wisdom, because also they had close, important diplomatic ties with the government. All right, next item in the Mishnah was Lo yigadel adam et hakelev elaim ken kashur b'shelaot. One may not raise dogs because they are dangerous and scare people unless they're tied with chains. Tenor banan. לא יגדל אדם את הכלב, אלא אם כן קשור בשלשלת. אבל מגדל הוא בעיר הסמוכה לספר, וקושרו ביום ומתירו בלילה. We have a braita that expands on the Mishnah and says one is not allowed to raise a dog unless it's tied with a chain. However, one is allowed to raise dogs in a city that's close to the border of the land, across the border are enemies, because the dog will offer protection. However, during the day when there's people walking around, you have to tie it up so that it won't scare and won't harm people. But at night, when people are in the house sleeping and you want to have protection at night in case there's any burglars or enemies lurking about, then you can let them go at night. So that's permitted if it's for protection. Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Hagadol Omer, Hamagadel Kalavim Kemadel Hazirim, Lemnayef Kamina, Lemekam Ale Be'arur. Rabbi Eliezer the Great says, one who raises dogs is the same as raising pigs. Now, either both of them are not allowed. So what is he saying? What is he adding by comparing raising dogs to pigs? And the answer is that not only is it prohibited, but it's also cursed. We saw already that there's a general prohibition against pigs, and that includes non-kosher animals, but that's the prohibition. The curse, we saw that it's after that story of the elder that spoke in Chochmat Yevanit, and then the brother, the Hasmonean brother who was outside, put a pig in the basket and raised the pig up. So then they said specifically, not only is it not allowed, but a curse come upon anyone who raises pigs. So Rabbi Eliezer Gadol is adding that the curse applies not only to pigs, but also to dogs. Rabbi says that the land of Bavel has the same law as a city that's on the border with enemy territory where one is allowed to raise dogs. So he seems to say that in general about all of Bavel. However, the Gemara says, and this does not mean all, doesn't mean all of Bavel, but rather Nehardeah. Nehardeah was close to the border. Nehardeah was near the border between the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire, and so there might be incursions and enemies are coming across, so then you can have a dog there as protection. Without that Gemara, if you just look at Rav Nachman's statement in its original, sounds like it might be all of Bavel. In fact, we do know from lots of historical records that having dogs as pets was very, very common in Persia. It was part of the culture. Everyone had dogs. So maybe he means something like that, since it's very common to have dogs and people know how to take care of them and people aren't scared of them. Okay. Darish Rabbi Dostai Demin Biri, Umnuchoyo Mashubad, Unaribot Alfe Israel, Lamedach Shen Shechina Shora Israel, Pachot Mishne Alafim, Ushne Rebavot. We're going to see why it should be prohibited and even have a curse upon someone who has dogs because of its danger. So, Rabbi Dostai says, that when the pasuk says ubnucho yomad, when the Aron Kodesh, but sometimes it was taken out to war and it would come back, so then they would the prayer was Shuvah Hashem. Hashem is represented. The Shekhinah is on the Aron, and so when it comes back, we say Hashem return to the tens of thousands and thousands of Israel. We say this pasuk today when we put the Sefer Torah back, because the Sefer Torah is like the Aron that's returning back to where it was. Anyway. This teaches that the Shekhinah rests on Israel only if there are at least 22,000 members. Where do you get that? Ribabot is plural, that means 10,000, so the minimum of plural is 2, so that's 2 10,000s, that's 20,000, and Alfe is also plural, and the minimum of thousands would be 2,000, so that's 22,000. You need at least that many people for there to be Shekhinah in that area. Chased Ahat. Now, if you're missing one person, let's say it's exactly 21,999 people. So Shekhinah is not going to rest on that community. Hayta isha me'oberet ben hemuriyah lashlim v'nabach ba'kele v'epila v'nimsa zeh godem Shekhinah shitistalek mi'Yisrael. But let's say there's a pregnant woman, and as soon as she gives birth, then it'll go up to 20,000, and then Shekhinah will rest on them. But then, before she gave birth, a dog came and barked at her, frightened her, and caused her a miscarriage. So that dog will cause Shekhinah to leave the Jewish people. So you see, right? One person can make all the difference, and one dog could ruin everything for everyone. Therefore, no dogs allowed. Hahi iteta da'alat mefa ba'hu beta nebach ba kalba amar la mare la tistefi mine shekuleni be amra le shekili tibutich v'shaja achizre kebar nad valad. And a similar story to this is a woman who went to a building to bake, and there was a dog there, and the dog barked at her, and the owner of the dog says, don't be afraid, its teeth have been removed. Here's some scary canine teeth, and they were removed, so it has no bite, don't worry about it. But she says, take your take your favor and throw it to the thorns, right? Thanks a lot. It's too late. The baby already moved from his place. It's already, the miscarriage already happened from the fear, from the fright of it. So it doesn't matter, even if it can't actually bite because you took the teeth out. Nevertheless, just bark can scare people, and especially scare someone sensitive like a pregnant woman. Can cause real damage, and therefore do not have scary dogs around. And porsin nishbin leyonim. The last halacha in the Mishnah is that you're not allowed to set traps for pigeons near a city, near a settled area, because people have their own private pigeons that fly around, and you can't put traps where people's private pigeons might be. Instead, you have to move it at least 30 ris, which is the same as 8,000 cubits, the same as 4 mil, away from the city, and that way you'll only catch wild pigeons and not privately owned pigeons. We ask, do pigeons really travel that much, 8,000 amot? V'hatanan, we have a Mishnah Baba Batra, Marchichin Tashabach min ha'ir, 50 ama. That if you have a dovecot, you should keep it away from the city, 50 amot, because we don't want the birds to go to people's private fields and eat from the fields. But if it's 50 amot away, then they won't fly that much. So you see from here that birds only fly 50 amot, and you said you have to keep it, you have to keep the traps away 8,000 amot. That's a lot more. Why? In fact, they do travel a lot. At least 8,000 amot, they can travel. And so you have to keep your traps that far away. However, when it comes to eating, once they travel 50 amot, they're already full. They, birds are able to find all the worms and food that they need within 50 amot from where they are. So as long as it's 50 amot away from the field of someone else, you don't have to worry that it will eat from the field. But it will fly farther than that. And now we ask from the opposite direction. Is that true that a bird only flies 30 ris, which is 4 mil? And then you can put your trap farther, 4 mil away from someone's private property. V'hatanya b'yishuv afilu me'amil lo yifros. Is another braita that says, if you're in a settled area, you are not allowed to put a trap even 100 mil away. 100 mil is a lot more than 4 mil, and that even that is not enough. So you see that birds travel quite a lot. Rav Yosef Amar b'yishuv Kedamim, Rabba Amar b'yishuv Shobachin, and the answer is when it says yishuv in settled area, it depends what it's settled with. So Rav Yosef says if it's settled with vineyards, so then vineyards are very nice, birds like it, like them, and they can rest on the way. If there are vineyards all along the way, then the bird can rest every few minutes whenever it gets tired, and if so, it can travel a very long time. In fact, we know from migration that birds can travel hundreds of miles as long as they have good places to rest in the middle. And Rabba says it's talking about a place that's settled with dovecotes, where also they can rest. As dovecotes every so often, they can rest there. So if there's places to rest along, then you cannot put a net even 100 mil away. But if there's no vineyard or dovecotes around, then you only have to keep your nets away for a meal, which is what the Mishnah was talking about. Last question, in this Braita, according to the last answer, they said there's dovecotes all along the way. So then, how come you're allowed to put your net 4 mil away from, let's say, the last dovecote? Why don't you have to worry about the dovecotes themselves, right? Since the Mishnah says that it's prohibited to put a net within 4 mil of a dovecote. So how can you explain the Braita according to Rabba's answer? Let's say there's 100 mil and dovecotes all along the way. So this sounds like after 100 mil, then you could put your net right next to that, the last dovecote. But how could you put it last next to the last dovecote according to the Braita, if our Mishnah teaches that it has to be yet another 4 amot away from that one? So what would be a case where one would be permitted to put his nets next to the dovecote that's far enough away, 100 mil away from the city. We're talking about where that last of code either belongs to a non-Jew. Now, you can't steal from a non-Jew either, but here it's not directly stealing. You're just putting a net, and there's a possibility that someone else's bird can fall in. So there, in that case, we wouldn't have to apply this gezerah, this prohibition, and worry to that extent. Or that these dovecotes are public property, that no one owns it. They're just there. Maybe someone used to own it and he moved away. So they're just there. And so then you don't have to worry about that last dovecote if the birds belong to someone, or if the person who's putting the net owns that dovecote itself. So then that's also permitted. So as long as it's 100 mil and more away from the city, you can put it, if he owns the last dovecote, he can put it within 4 mil of that last dovecote. Hadran alach merubeh. We now begin the 8th perek that deals with the 5 types of compensation for injury of one human to another. Hachovel b'chavero chayav alav mishum hamisha devarim benezek besa'a b'ripui b'shevet u'boshet. If one person injures another person, this excludes animals, either the animal as the victim or as the injurer. One does not pay these 5, is only humans. One has to pay 5 different types of compensation. One for the damage, for the feeling of pain, for medical costs, for the loss of livelihood, as long as he cannot work, and for the feeling of humiliation or shame that comes along with that injury. How so? Benezek kesad, simet aino, katat yado, shiberet raglo, ro'ino toki ilu hu aibed nimkar bashuk, v'shamin kama haya yafe v'kama hu yafe. How do we estimate the amount of the damage? If a person blinded someone, took out his eye, or cut off his arm, or broke his leg. So we evaluate his market value as a slave. How much is he worth now? And how much was he worth before the injury? And you subtract the difference, and so that is the amount of injury. We do not assess it with how much would you pay for someone to cut off your arm. That would be probably a lot more. I mean, how much would you say, okay, you can take my arm if you give me what, 1 million, 10 million, 100 million? Most people wouldn't take any money in the world to lose that kind of quality of life. But the amount on a slave market is a calculable number, how much someone can work with one hand versus how much 2 hands. And so that is how we calculate a sa'ad. Keva'o bishpud o bemasmer afilu al siporno makom she'eno ose haburamdim kama adam kayose bahze rose litoliot mista'er kach. Pain. If someone, for example, burns someone else with a hot skewer or a nail, even if it's on someone's finger nail, where it's not going to cause a bruise, but that is a sensitive area that will cause a lot of pain. So all right, let's assume it doesn't cause a bruise, but it's painful for that at that time when the hot skewer is touching him. So then we estimate how much would a person take in order to have that much suffering. And that's a number, right? How much for 10 seconds of burning hot pain on your fingernail? What would you take to do that? I don't know, $1,000, $10,000? There's a number that people would be willing to suffer through. Ripui hikahu chayav lerapoto. If there's medical costs, then the injurer has to pay for all the medical costs. Ala bo semachim, im mechamat makah chayav, shelo mechamat makah patur. If there grows blisters or rashes, if it's because of the injury, that not only is there injury, but then there's an infection, and that has to be taken care of. So all the anything that results from the injury, he has to pay. But if it just happens to be that there are some blisters and rashes in the same area, but it's not because of the injury, then the injurer does not have to pay for that. Chaytav nistera, chaytav nistera, chayav lerapoto. Chaytav kol surka, eno chayav lerapoto. If it got better and then got worse again, it healed and then it opened up again, healed and opened up again, he has to keep paying for it until it's totally probably better. However, if it became 100% fully healed, and then afterwards it got bad for a different reason, then it's not the injurer's fault. He doesn't have to pay for that anymore, but he does have to pay, even if it keeps coming back, if it never fully healed. Shebet ro'ino tok iluhu shomer kishuin shekavan natan lo deme yado udme raglo. The loss of livelihood, you don't have to pay him for the full amount of his current livelihood if it depends on one of his limbs, but rather you only have to pay him minimum wage, just the amount that a watchman of cucumbers would get, because you already paid compensation for his hand or for his leg if it's something that depends on it. So let's say you have a professional quarterback. So he relies on his arm. He makes $1 million a year. Someone cuts off his arm. So that guy, you're going to have to pay him already for his arm and for that loss, for the injury, that will include already the loss of use of his arm. So therefore, in addition to that, you're going to have to pay for his loss of work. Now, he's not going to work as a quarterback anymore, but that doesn't matter, because we already took that into account for the nezik, and therefore the loss of work only has to be paid as minimum wage. And what can he do without an arm? Well, he can sit and watch cucumbers all day. That doesn't take much much physical strength or particular effort, and so for this he only gets minimum wage. And this would be if in fact this was something that caused that kind of nezik, if he needs his arm to do his job. But let's say it was some other kind of injury. Maybe he's a quarterback, but the injury has nothing to do with his playing football, and he just gave him a stomach ache. And so he can't play football for that time, in which case he's not accounting for it in the nezik, but he misses three games, and those three games is worth $100,000. So then he would have to pay $100,000, right? This fact that you pay as a watchman of cucumbers is only if his loss of doing his job was already accounted for in the nezik. But if not, then he would have to pay whatever his compensation he's getting for his professional skill. Humiliation depends. It's very subjective how much one feels humiliated. If someone comes and slaps you, a slap is a good example because it doesn't cause much injury. It doesn't even hurt that much, but it's very humiliating, especially in public. So in that case, it depends on who does it and who the receiver is. If someone very important slaps you, I don't know, the Queen of England or something, I don't think she's alive anymore, she couldn't do it, but someone very important slaps a lowly person, that's not so humiliating. Like, oh, look, the king, you know, he even paid attention to me. So that's not as bad as if some lowlife comes and slaps you, then that humiliation is worse. So the lowlife would actually have to pay more than the king. And then also, that's the mivayesh. Also, the mitbayesh, the one who gets slapped, if he's a very important person, very well known and respected, and someone comes and slaps him in public, that causes a lot of embarrassment. But if it's someone who's a lowlife anyway, and a nobody, and someone comes and slaps him, so then he doesn't feel that much embarrassment. So it all is subjective. We're going to see in a few pages the opinion of Rabbi Akiva that says everybody in the Jewish nation is like a prince, and therefore is all equal. We don't have classes. Okay, Gemara says, Amai ayin tachat ayin marachamana, ema ayin mamash. The question is, for nezik, how come you have to pay the amount of the arm? How much is a person's value with his arm and without? So if someone cuts off someone's arm or knocks out his eye, he has to pay. How do you know? The pasuk says ayin tachat ayin, which literally means an eye for an eye. So why don't we say this means an actual eye, that the perpetrator gets his eye knocked out if he did that to someone else? Okay, very important question. How do we know we shouldn't take this pasuk literally? Here's the pasuk in context. It says that imason yihyeh, is talking about two men fighting, and they knock into a pregnant woman, and there is damage to the pregnant woman. So then, nefesh tachat nefesh, a life for a life. If they kill the mother, this pregnant woman on the side, then they get capital punishment. That's corporeal punishment. So you might think very well that ayin tachat ayin, shen tachat shen, yad tachat yad, regel tachat regel, kivya tachat kivya, pesa tachat pas, chabura tachat chabura. No matter what it is, where it is on the body, or a burn, or a wound, or a bruise, that you'd have to do that to the perpetrator. So how do you know that this should mean that this whole pasuk means a monetary payment? The answer is two. La saka da tichtetanya, we have a braita. Answer number one in the braita. Yachol simet, I know, mesemet, I know. Katat yado mekatat yado. Shibet raglo meshibet raglo. Tamud omar makeh adam umakeh behema. Ma makeh behema de tashlumin, af makeh adam le tashlumin. So should we read it literally? That if someone blinds someone else, we blind him. If he cuts off his hand, we cut off his hand. If the perpetrator breaks someone's leg, then we break his leg. Should we think that? That's why the pasuk says and compares injuring a person to injuring an animal. Just like if I injure someone's animal, I pay. I don't get injured myself back. So too, if I injure a person, also there is payment. It's not clear immediately what pasuk this is referring to, so Gemara is going to elaborate. V'im nafshecha lomad. And if you, for some reason, you're not convinced with that answer, so I'll give you another one. This is all part of the Braita. Interesting that the Braita is offering two answers here. Arehu omer, lo tikhu chofel lenefesh roseach asher hu rasha lamut. Lenefesh roseach I ata lokeach chofel, aval ata lokeach chofel lerashe ebarim she'en hozrin. The pasuk says, do not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death. Here's the pasuk in its context. Anyone who kills someone, the killer will be killed on the basis of evidence. That has to be two witnesses. One witness is not enough. And then, so that's for the one point, that you need proper evidence. And you cannot take ransom for the person's life. Say, oh, listen, I know I murdered someone, but I'll pay. I'll pay $1 million. I'll pay $10 million. No, you can't. No matter how much, a person cannot ransom his life if he's guilty of capital punishment, right? Asher hu rasha, because he is guilty. Lamut, he had deserving death. Rather, you must kill him. Okay, we say the same thing also for Ir Miklat. If someone kills by mistake, also you cannot accept ransom. Rather, he has to get that physical punishment of going into exile. So what do we learn from here? Lenefesh Roseach, that this law that you cannot take ransom instead of death, that only applies to a murderer, right? Only Lenefesh Roseach, you do not take ransom. But you can take ransom in another case. What case would that be? If you kill someone's limbs. It's also a death to the limb because it's not going to come back. She'en chozrim, that do not regenerate. So even though that's a kind of killing part of a person, but that is excluded. Only lenefesh roseach, only a murderer, someone who kills someone else, you cannot take ransom. But a person who injures someone else, you can take ransom. It's kind of like saying, you know, really from the letter of the law or the essence of morality, it would be fitting to take out someone's eye if they took out someone else's eye. But you can pay ransom. So there is a case of paying ransom. If someone's animal kills someone else, then literally, pasuk says, he has to die. But we say, okay, or you can pay ransom. So there is such a thing as, you know, literally you deserve a corporeal punishment, but you can pay ransom instead of it. So that's the idea here, that this pasuk is saying no ransom for a murderer. It implies yes ransom for an injurer. Hey, makeh. Now, that finished. That's the end of the baraita. Now, the first proof of the baraita that compared someone who injures a man and someone who injures an animal, just like injuring an animal you pay, so to injuring a human. So where is this pasuk? He make. I lema make behema yishalemena u make behema yumat. Hahu biktalaketiv. If it's this pasuk in Vayikra 24:21, someone who strikes an animal pays, but someone who strikes, meaning and kills, a human, he should die. But that's talking about a murderer. That's not talking about injury. Let's look at this pasukim in context, because we're going to analyze this entire paragraph. This is a very important paragraph. Let's look at the whole thing. We're going to analyze pretty much every pasuk in here. So the structure is follows. If a human kills another human, he gets a death penalty, period. Someone who strikes, meaning and kills. Makeh can mean hit. It can mean hit to and cause injury. It sometimes means hit and causes death. It depends on the context. So here it means if someone murders, kills an animal, then he pays. A life for a life, meaning the value of the life, but actually this is a very important pasuk, because even though it says nefesh, tachat, nafesh, it has the same form of this tachat, that, still it's clear that it means to pay. So you can have such a thing that this phrase does mean to pay. So number one, we see the difference between killing a human, death penalty, killing an animal, payment. If someone injures another human being, whatever was done, whatever he did, that's what's done to him. Midah keneged midah. For example, Sheber tachat sheber, ayin tachat ayin, shen tachat shen, kasher yiten mum ba'adam, ken yinaten bo. A fracture for an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, the injury that inflicted on a human being shall be inflicted in return. So this is our very question. Does this mean literally corporeal punishment, or does it mean payment? This is the pasuk that we just now, the Gemara is now discussing. The last pasuk seems to be summarizing the beginning, the first two pasukim, and saying there's a contrast. Someone who kills an animal will pay. Someone who kills a human will get the death penalty. Okay, so right now we're trying to derive it from this pasuk here, since we're looking for the pasuk that the Braita was referring to in its first proof. So maybe it's referring to this one because it's comparing makeh behema and makeh adam, and here's a pasuk that has these two phrases, makeh behema, makeh adam, and compares them together. And just so therefore, just like when injury, even killing an animal, one pays, so too we can learn that injury to a human being also would be payment. But then we reject this because this is talking about murder. And so here, makeh adam yumat clearly means if it's murder, then there's no payment instead. Rather, he receives capital punishment. So this is behahu bekatalakativ. So that can't be the pasuk that the Braita is referring to. Rather, the Braita is referring to an earlier pasuk, also in this same paragraph. Ela me'acha, makeh nefesh behema yishalemena, nefesh tachat nefesh, usmich le, v'ish ki yiten mum ba'amito, kasher asa ken ya'ase lo, hay lav makehu, haka'a kamrinan, ma'aka amura behema letashlumin, af haka amura be'adam letashlumin. So rather, it's from the two earlier pasukim. One pasuk says, someone who strikes an animal will pay, even kills an animal, because it's nefesh, tachat nefesh. If he kills an animal, then he has to pay. That is pasuk 18. So that's here. And the very next pasuk is talking about a human injuring another human, and it says you do the same thing to him, ayin tachat ayin. So since 18 and 19 are all back to back, so that means it's the same punishment for them, just like you pay for an animal, so too you pay for injuring a human being. Okay, this we understand this juxtaposition. The problem with this is that the Braita said that we're comparing the word makeh to each other, right? Look back here, and mentions here makeh behema, makeh adam, makeh behema, and it doesn't say the word makeh, and it says makeh behema. It doesn't say the word makeh in this pasuk. It just says ki ten mum ba amito. There's no word makeh. So how are you going to make what gezerah shava are you making between the two? So therefore, we question this derivation, right? This is there's no makeh la makehu, and the answer is what we mean is not the word makeh, but the concept of injury is here found in both. Just like injury regarding an animal, you have to pay, so to injury regarding a human, you have to pay. This is actually very important, the fact that you can make a gezerah shava, even if you don't have the exact same word, but you have the concept, which is in some cases even stronger, because sometimes these are words that are quite common, but the concept is very important. But here, it might not be a gezerah shava, it might actually be a hekesh, the fact that these two pesukim are back-to-back. So that's what the Baraita meant. When it says makeh, we're not looking at the words, it's not a gezerah shava, just the fact that the concept is back-to-back. That's how we learn it. Now we ask, V'haketi v'ish ki yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat. We challenge from the pasuk at the beginning of the paragraph. Remember this one here. Ish ki yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat. That is surely talking about capital punishment. And therefore, just like this capital punishment for murder, a corporeal punishment, maybe that means also for the loss of a limb. Also, there will be corporeal punishment. So we answer, no, b'mamon, this is talking about only paying. Mimayde b'mamon, ema b'mita mamash. How do you know it means only paying? Maybe it means actual death. Just like if it's murder, you give capital punishment, which is corporeal. Maybe also if one gives death to just a limb, then there is corporeal punishment and you cut off the person's limb. So maybe we should compare it to this, Pasuk 17, which is in fact corporeal punishment. No, don't think that for two reasons. Number one, the injury is actually more closely related to the injury of an animal. It's right back to back. You see here, it does look like a hekesh rather than a gezer hashava. So this is the one that's immediately before injury of a person, where also it says ayin tachat ayin and so on. So these are back to back, whereas Pasuk 17 is farther away. Therefore, number one, it makes sense to compare injury of a human to injury of an animal, and therefore that should be payment. Furthermore, the pasuk afterwards that says, as one gives an injury to someone else, there so too he should give it. Yinaten. Natan. What do you give? You give money, right? That's something that is given over from hand to hand. Here is your money. So that word by itself indicates a monetary payment. Good. So now that we explained the first proof in the Braita, we like it a lot. So we ask, Umay im nafshecha lomar, why does the Braita give a second proof, as if you want a second proof, as if there's something wrong with the first one? What would be not convincing about the first proof? Tu ka kashya letana. See, the Gemara is never happy. If it explains the proof, if the proof is not good, it has to explain it. If the proof is too good, it has to explain what's wrong with it and why we would need another one. So, yes, in fact, the Tana did have a challenge to the first proof. Why did you decide to compare injury of a human to injury of an animal, which is payment? Maybe it should be injury of a human, because it should be compared to murder of a human, which is corporeal. Now for that, we have an answer, which makes sense to compare one injury to another injury, and not compare a case of injury to a case of the death penalty. So injury to injury would be injury to of a human compared to injury to an animal, and both of those are payment. And don't give me injury of a human to death to a murder of a human. Those are different. But we respond with another question. If you want to talk about categories, it doesn't actually make more sense to compare humans to humans and animals to animals. So if we're going to put humans together, just like killing a human is a corporeal punishment of death penalty, so too injuring and cutting off a limb of a human should also be corporeal punishment. You take off the limb, and don't bring me an animal, which is a completely separate category. So that in fact is a problem, even though we said before that it's back to back. So that's so the first proof stands. It's a good proof because these pisukim are in fact near each other, the injury to an animal and the injury to a human. Nevertheless, you might have a question that maybe even though it's one pasuk before, maybe it makes more sense to compare humans to humans. Animals is always payment, whether you injure them or kill them. And maybe humans is always a corporeal punishment. And that's why we give another proof. Haynu dekatane im nafshecha lomar harehu omer. Lo tikhu chofer nefesh osech asher rasha lamut kimot yumat lemesh osech I ata lokeach chofer aval ata lokeach chofer asher barim she'enan chozrim. So we have a second proof. And if you want, I can say from this pasuk, do not take a ransom for a murderer because he is an evildoer. He deserves to die. So therefore, you have to give him the death penalty. So this says only for a murderer, you cannot take ransom, but you can take ransom for someone who doesn't kill a person totally, but only kills one limb. That is okay, as if it's a limb that doesn't regenerate, so you killed it, then you can take ransom instead. Hold on, is this pasuk coming to teach this and exclude the ransom problem for an injury to a limb and say, yes, you can pay, but we need this pasuk for something else. We learn from this pasuk already the rule of kim leb de rabamine, that you don't give someone two punishments for one thing, that you shouldn't give a person two things and take money from him and also kill him, right? That's what it means. That's what the pasuk means. Don't take kofed, ransom, and then also kill him. No, you pick one or the other, and so you'll pick the harsher punishment generally. That's what we already learned from that. Hi, mikedeli shato nafka, rishachad ata mechayevo, v'yata mechayevo shete rishayot. So no, we don't need this pasuk in Vayikra to teach us that principle. We already know it from the words kedeli shato. You have to punish him according to his evil doing, which is singular. And so therefore that teaches that one is only liable for one punishment for one act, and you don't get two punishments for two evil doings, meaning even though what this one act caused two things, like if you burnt down someone's field and you made the fire on Shabbat, so even though these are shtei rishayot, these are two evil doings, but since they're in the same act, one only gets one punishment. So we already have devarim for that. That leaves the Bimidbar pasuk free. Right, the Bimidbar pasuk is the one about kofir. Well, we still need the pasuk in Bimidbar for the halacha that one cannot take money and be exempt from death. In other words, we need it for the peshat that a murderer can't pay money and not get death. We need the pasuk just for that. So how are you learning something else from it that, yes, you can't pay ransom, but something else you can? There are extra words in the pasuk. The pasuk could have just said, don't take ransom for an evildoer to die. Why do you have to add also lenefesh roseach? Right, look at the pasuk here. It could have skipped these words, lenefesh roseach. Asher rasha lamut. Why have said lenefesh roseach? So that comes to add, shema mina lenefesh roseach, yata lokeh kofer, aval tel kofer asher barim she'enan chozrim. It's only for the one who murders an entire person. That person, that murderer, cannot pay ransom. But you can take a ransom for someone who only kills a limb. Now that you have this second proof in the Baraita, which seems very, very good, why do we need the first one at all? That makes the hekesh, a juxtaposition of strike of injury to an animal and injury to a human, that both are payment. Amre ime hai havamina iba'e aino netib iba'e deme aino netib kamashmalan bima mama ke behemad letashlumin af meke adam letashlumin. If I had only the pasuk in Devarim about paying a ransom, I would say, well, whatever they decide, if a person can choose to pay with his eye and take out his eye, because that's the letter of the law. And then if he decides, you know what, I want to pay instead, so then he can pay ransom instead of that. So I might have thought that taking out someone's eye is a real choice, and the person says, yeah, take out my eye, I don't want to pay, then that we would actually take out his eye, which would be kind of gory. And so therefore, if we need the first derivation to learn that when it comes to an animal, there's no possibility that you'd say, well, if you cut off the limb of an animal, you're going to cut off the person's limb who caused the injury. No, there it only says payment. And nobody would think that you would give corporeal punishment for injuring an animal. And therefore, also for a human, we need the first proof to teach us that there's no possibility, not allowed, to give corporeal punishment for an injury at all. Baruch Adonai Leolam. Amen ve'amen.